It's Wednesday, October 7th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ruben Stern. On our program this week, President Obama is the nation's assignment editor-in-chief. He called for journalists to report side-by-side the number of Americans killed in terrorist attacks since 9/11 versus those killed by gun violence. Several news outlets did as asked. Did the president use them to play politics? Hillary Clinton's weekend date with NBC, first showing up on Saturday Night Live, and then Monday's town hall on the Today Show. How'd she do? And while it seemed the media was looking to Hurricane Joaquim, a thousand-year flood rained down on South Carolina. There's a whole lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but we'll start with Thursday. The nation stood numb once again as word spread of another mass shooting. This time at a community college in Roseburg, Oregon, Chris Harper Mercer, armed with a small arsenal of weapons, went to the Umpqua Community College campus. He entered a classroom and he started shooting. For 10 minutes, he looked his victims in the eye, asked them about their faith, and shot them. 10 people, including the shooter, died. Another 9 were wounded. And when Douglas County Sheriff John Hanlon spoke to the media Thursday, he refused to even utter Mercer's name.
I will not name the shooter. I will not give him the credit he probably sought prior to this horrific and cowardly act. Media will get the name confirmed in time, but you will never hear me mention his name.
It's important. I think we can focus on what would cause somebody to do this horrendous act, and I absolutely agree with the previous statement that the focus should be on how many people opened their hearts to help us today.
That was the college's president, Dr. Rita Cavan, who spoke alongside Hanlon. His decision not to name the shooter publicly, it's part of a national movement called No Notoriety. Last year, Karen and Tom Teeves started the campaign. Their son, Alex, was among the 12 gunned down in the Aurora movie theater shooting back in 2013. Their claim is that when the media names mass shooters like Mercer or WDBJ shooter Vester Flanagan or the theater shooter in Aurora, Colorado, James Holmes, we're giving them the fame and notoriety that they're looking for, and ultimately forgetting the victims that they took from us. There has been some evidence that shows coverage of one mass shooting can lead to another, that there's a chain effect there.
Well, you know, I think it's not as clear-cut as all of that.
Okay.
I mean, that doesn't mean that common sense doesn't suggest to you that there's probably a copycat effect or whatever. It doesn't mean that people are wrong to push this. I really understand it. If you had a loved one, you're a parent, a spouse, a friend, whatever, I get that. But the research on this is not yet definitive. I mean, there's research that says when it comes to suicides, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that media coverage can exacerbate that and lead to copycats. And that's why a lot of newsrooms have different policies now about covering public suicides than they used to do. But the research on whether or not media have an impact on copycats and these mass shootings is just not really there yet. There's a couple of studies. There's one that came out from Arizona State this summer that purports to show it, but they're very careful in the conclusions they draw about that. So I don't know that we have proof that it happens, and there's a lot of reasons to think about whether or not, you know, in the total cost-benefit analysis of all of this, whether we really want to not name names.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, Brian Stelter of CNN wrote about this. He linked to one of the studies that actually talked about the contagion effect, I think is the phrase that they use. And I found it interesting that, you know, that study also pointed out that there's a correlation between the prevalence of guns in a state and these incidents that occur, but that's not what the sheriff is standing there talking about. So to signal out the media and not talk about all the other things that contribute, you know, it's not a full sort of explanation of what is going to help reduce these things.
I know one of the problems that I personally have with the idea of the No Notoriety campaign and not naming a shooter is that as journalists, we deal in information. And the name of a shooter in this case is a salient point in the story that we're telling as we record that first version, that first account of history.
Yeah, and certainly if you're talking about wanting to come up with an explanation for why something occurred, and you need an explanation if you're going to try, you know, potentially to do something about it, journalists have got to be able to unveil those details. That doesn't mean that we can't be careful about how we approach witnesses and victims early on. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be careful about how often or in what context we display videos and other, you know, information about a crime. But to just say, well, we're going to know the name, but we're not going to tell you the name, I mean, there are lots of reasons why you have to be careful about doing that. And again, I mean, if you take the sheriff, I mean, I get it when a parent or a research scientist or somebody says, you know, let's take this seriously. We need to think about this. This sheriff had a lot of other stuff going on. For example, the fact that he wrote a very strident letter to the vice president after the Newtown shootings, basically saying, you know, over my dead body, are there going to be any restrictions on guns? He also may, though he denies it, have posted on his Facebook page a sort of sympathetic link to the truthers around Newtown who claimed that it was a big government conspiracy with actors portraying the parents. So let's be careful about what his motivation might have been too.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And, you know, another thing that I would say here is, you know, it's about proportionality. And I think that's really what people are upset about. It's not just, you know, the media named the names of them, although that is, you know, one end of the spectrum. But I think the real problem is, you know, are we making good decisions in the media about how much we talk about things and how many times that name comes up and how many times we flash the mugshot of the shooter on the screens of television and how big we play that on the front of our newspapers. I think that's a conversation that is, in fact, shaping the way that media are covering these things over time. And so, you know, this idea that you're never going to name the shooter, I think, is kind of the extreme point that is dragging the actual media coverage back to a place that's slightly more responsible than what we have seen, you know, in the past.
If I could just say, too, a little bit more, Amy, about the research part of it, because although I think it is true that there isn't a lot of definitive research on this topic out there, one of the reasons that there isn't, that we really ought to make clear, is that Congress, being lobbied by the NRA, has in the past stopped people like the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, from doing this kind of research by threatening their appropriations. President Obama, after Newtown a couple of years ago, issued an executive order saying, we will do that kind of research. 2 years later, the Washington Post is still reporting that they haven't done it. Mm-hmm. Why? Are they afraid of their careers and reputations if they try to do this? Are they worried because Congress still won't appropriate funds specifically for that kind of research? I mean, we could be doing more of it than we are doing, and you can lay the blame at Congress and the NRA for not doing it.
Well, as we have this conversation, I will say we obviously did use the name, and that is coming in part, and there's an article on our Links blog that spells this out directly, that the NPR ombudsman has come forward and said that NPR and its member stations should use the name again, that it is part of the record of what happened and information that people should have. I also want to mention Tom Teeves, who is the founder, along with his wife, of this campaign, is going to be here on campus next week, participating in and will be a speaker at a conference that's going to be held here at RJI on trauma journalism and training for educators in that area and in that space.
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to be worth attending and getting more insights and more details about this, because, you know, I have to think that when it really comes down to it, part of the problem with people who are calling for this, legitimately calling for this kind of no notoriety campaign, is that, you know, we as an audience, we say that we, you know, when something like this happens, we want all the details. We want the breaking news. We want to know why it's happening, how it's happening, pictures of it happening, until all of a sudden we don't. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because we feel a little dirty about it, or we feel a little guilty because we're not doing anything about it, or a little helpless because those in power aren't doing anything about it. And so we focus on one thing that we think we could have some control over, which is trying to convince the media not to name a name. Not that that maybe doesn't have some relevance, but it seems in the grand scheme of things not to be the most important thing we could be doing.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to point at the media and say, if you would just not report his name, then these things wouldn't happen, as opposed to looking at all of the complexity around it and really having that conversation about what is broken in our system that enables these things to keep happening. And that's a very complex question that I think is really challenging for average people to want to talk about.
Well, we're living in a different day and different time, so it should come as no surprise that Umpqua students tweeted a lot as they were running for their lives last Thursday. Twitter user KP Kayla Marie tweeted saying, "Students are running everywhere, holy God." And within seconds, journalists from CNN, ABC News, and the New York Daily News were at replying to her, asking her to follow so that they could direct message her and get more details about what they were seeing and experiencing at that time. Well, the public didn't take well to that approach and immediately came back at them on Twitter, calling these journalists out as vultures, insensitive, and opportunistic. Again, I have to say, this seems like another one of those times when maybe the public doesn't really understand how we're doing our jobs. Before social media was a thing, we would pick up something called the crisscross directory that would be a reverse telephone directory based on address. And if there was spot news going on, we would call every telephone number on that block until someone could describe it. It's really not that different. It's just out there and in the open.
Yeah, I suspect that people would be aghast if they found out what went into all sorts of products that they consume on a daily basis. This just happens to be television news in a breaking news situation.
Yeah.
And that is the process. And, you know, I can see from the individual standpoint of that Twitter user, you know, it would be overwhelming to have a lot of people knocking on your door. But that's how news has always worked. And it's really interesting that now we have the situation where everyone else can weigh in on what they think that is about.
Well, and in fact, when you say that, it used to be that what we did do is we called people on the phone or we knocked on their door. We stuck a microphone in their face. And in some ways, I mean, those things still happened.
Mm-hmm. Usually
using social media, you are, you know, careful in the language you use, and if you are truly empathetic, not just trying to be perceived as mm-hmm. being empathetic, and you understand the situation that the witness or the, you know, potential victim or whatever is in, there's nothing particularly wrong with using social media to do it. And I'll say one other thing. If you think that this is, you know, excessive now, there are companies out there that are using not only real-time monitoring of Twitter and other social media, but they're combining that with geolocation data and certain keywords that they see coming up when there's a kind of a tragedy or an emergency situation to try to track these things down even faster to get a jump on them. So you're going to see more rather than less of this.
Yeah, I mean, how do you think all these journalists found that one Twitter user who posted that one tweet? Well, they are using these tools already, and it's part of how that's happening. I think part of it, too, is, you know, we have a media system at the moment that swarms around these stories. And I think what this situation highlights is that fact that we now have this situation where, you know, lots of different people are trying to be first with stories, and that is highly valued by the audience. And therefore, in order to serve the audience that wants news now and they want more information now and they want to know exactly what's going on now and they expect that to happen immediately and not tomorrow morning when the paper comes out, there's more and more competition to get that information right now. And this Twitter thing is just an example of what that means.
So Ernest isn't here with us today, but he is always the first to say that our reporting needs more context. And after this mass shooting, so too is President Obama.
I would ask news organizations, because I won't put these facts forward, have news organizations tally up the number of Americans who've been killed through terrorist attacks over the last decade and the number of Americans who've been killed by gun violence, and post those side by side on your news reports. This won't be information coming from me. It will be coming from you.
How about that? Our assignment editor-in-chief, the president, asked. And there were a lot of news organizations that delivered.
Yeah. And you know, I understand at least the frustration. Take the politics out of it for a second. I mean, one of the first things he said was, this is just becoming routine. The media coverage is routine. My announcements and reaction to it are routine. And he's absolutely right. That's the way it is. And so he's trying to break through the routine somehow or another for an agenda that he thinks makes sense. And so he said, hey, journalists, go ahead. I dare you basically to check these things out. And they did. And what do you find? You find that if you compare those numbers, the number of Americans killed by terrorists versus the number of Americans killed by gun violence, well, of course, there's many, many thousands of more people killed by gun violence. What is the point he was trying to make with that? And did journalists sort of explore that question with some subtlety, or did they just run a chart that prove the point he was trying to make? That's an interesting question to me.
Yeah, and it's because, you know, solving this is a really complicated thing. And so trying to facilitate a conversation in the American mindset about, okay, what do we do about this thing we all agree is a problem? You know, there's a million different opinions about what needs to be done here. And throwing one statistic into the mix may or may not be the right way to actually facilitate that conversation. But again, that's really, really hard when we have a media system that becomes increasingly focused on what just happened today. And then tomorrow, there'll be something else happening tomorrow that we're going to focus this television media system on, and a lot of these breaking news websites, things like that. You know, it's not a real fertile ground to have a deep conversation.
You know, and I think he's certainly on the right side of public opinion when it comes to whether or not most Americans believe we need to do something about the easy accessibility of guns for some people. I mean, regardless of what Congress or the NRA might say, poll after poll after poll shows that the vast majority of Americans believe something needs to be done. On the other hand, a lot of Americans also believe we need to do something more about our mental health system and screening and helping people who in a situation like this. There are lots of people who think that there need to be more security measures taken. And I don't know that any of those things is actually getting a lot of traction. It's there, not even a holistic approach that people advocate for is really anyone is doing anything.
Or there are people who think the exact opposite, that instead of additional security measures, or maybe this is a security measure, it depends on your personal perception, that perhaps we should be having concealed carry on campuses like this one. It depends on how you look at it.
And I understand all of the arguments about, do we really want our students to have to, you know, basically live on a military base? Do we want them to have guns around them all the time? Would those work? On the other hand, there was a really interesting piece that one of our students surfaced the other day in this conversation that basically said, hey, what would journalists do if these crazed gunmen were targeting news organizations and newsrooms and not schools? You can bet we'd have all kinds of security and we'd be advocating for it.
Well, in a lot of ways, you know? Though, I mean, I look back at all of the television stations that I worked in during the course of my career, and they did all have bulletproof glass leading up to the newsroom and then surrounding the newsroom. You couldn't get into the building without clearance from a security officer. In all honesty, I don't remember if the security officers were armed or not, but you couldn't get into a building without them. You couldn't, as a guest, get in without specific clearance, and a guest had to come and actually escort you in. Right. So I don't know, maybe newsrooms do already have some of those procedures in place a little bit more than some others. But at the same time, here at the University of Missouri, we're on public state property too, which makes it a lot harder to secure some of those locations in the same way.
And that's part of this conversation at large is, you know, how feasible is it to secure every place where people are going to be in order to prevent one, you know, person who wants to upset that
and
peace.
And if somebody
from
wants
doing
to
it,
upset the peace, they're going to upset the peace.
Potentially. I mean, that's, you know, we have airport screening and all that. And again, this is the large conversation that winds up springing from this when you get out of the breaking news situation. And that is a hard conversation to have in an intelligent way. And this gets back to Obama. Increasingly, when we can't even agree on the basic facts that we're talking about. And I think that was actually somewhat wise of Obama in that sense to say, look, I'm not going to put an opinion out there. You guys report some facts here that we can all look at, and then we can have a conversation based on facts. So I disagree with Obama sort of setting the agenda for what journalists are supposed to do, but I think it's a kind of wise thing to say, let's get more facts into this conversation and get off of the opinions that everyone has so that we can actually have an intelligent conversation.
And let's consider facts from a variety of points of view. I mean, for example, law enforcement has learned tragically over the years following all these shootings that we don't stand back and wait. You know, we charge in and we confront the gunman immediately. We know that we're training people, students and others in workplaces. You can't just be, you know, passive about this. Somebody's got to try to take down the shooter, or you might have 20 people killed instead of 5 people killed. As horrible a calculus as that is, we are learning some other facts about this situations too.
Yeah, and I'll play the role of Ernest in terms of context here. I mean, thankfully, there were news organizations that were doing some of that contextual work, or at least through social media, these stories were getting out. So there were stories about the student who actually charged the gunman and, you know, wound up with a bunch of bullet holes as a result of that. And, I mean, those contextual stories of what else went on besides a single person going in and creating this situation, I mean, all of that activity gets reported out eventually. And so, you know, trying to figure out all those reporters sending those tweets to that one person was not just trying to figure out who is the shooter. It was trying to figure out what are all the other things going on here that are going to give us the full context around this.
And, you know, as depressing as all of this is, and the lack of answers seems to be, you know, sort of the theme here. Before we get off of it, I thought there was an interesting piece from the DART Center, which focuses on journalists covering traumatic situations. Mm-hmm. And they actually did have some, I thought, some interesting recommendations for things that journalists can do to tell these stories better. I mean, they're not going to stop the violence, maybe, but be precise about the language you use, because how we describe these gunmen may or may not affect whether other people do the same thing. Be careful about things like their manifestos or their social media posts, especially now that people are posting their own videos,
as
they did in the Virginia
shooting.
And that's
part of the no-notoriety campaign, is to not publish the manifestos.
Or at least be careful about how we publish or what pieces we publish or how often we bring those stories up in the next day's stories and the follow-on stories. And another one I thought was really important is, think about the experts, quote unquote, that you choose to put on the air in the paper. Think about what their, you know, what their qualifications are, because lots of people come out of the woodwork to be experts at a time like this. It's important for journalists to make sure that these people know what they're talking about and can prove it.
Okay, very quickly, I want to talk about the TV news weather machine that turned up to 11, warning people along the East Coast that Hurricane Joaquin was on its way, picking up strength as it moved up and then north through the Caribbean. But what they weren't so well prepared for, the effect the storm might have, and that it was going to weaken and take a sharp turn east, and South Carolina would find itself drowning in floodwaters. More than 18 dams breached, nearly a dozen died, if not more, by the time this program airs tonight. And the flooding, well, it's as bad as anything we have seen since Katrina, but it seems like reporters are struggling to tell this story in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, talk about journalistic playbooks. I mean, we turn on the television news and we keep seeing reporters knee deep in water everywhere, like they can't find dry ground or something. I'm being a bit facetious here, but, you know, there are these conventions that we keep sticking to in journalism, and it's funny.
Cliche. We're not getting the story itself.
It's not just that, but the way people are consuming news is different now. So if I'm there on a mobile phone in a noisy place, imagine I'm young too. I mean, I'm not. I'd like to imagine.
Oh,
it, but,
you're young.
But I'm watching this on my phone, and what I see is this guy with a microphone and a big logo standing in water, and I think, well, that's kind of ridiculous. Like, why
go
is he
inside.
Doing that? Right. Go stand somewhere dry.
Yeah.
And then tell me the story. Or better yet, go show me footage of what's going on. And this is, I think, one of the conventions of television news that's causing a lot of problems these days and causing other organizations like Vice and some of the other upstarts to be gaining traction with younger audiences, is because they abandon that sort of visual cliche and they move into stuff that is much more compelling visually. So I just noticed that as I was watching all this coverage.
I mean, to be fair, it was what the governor of South Carolina was describing as a 1,000-year flood. These things don't happen all that often, so there's not a lot of opportunity for us to prepare for them. But there are some tropes like that. I mean, I think about – you want to talk about don't give any notoriety. Stop showing video of these idiots driving their trucks and their cars into water and then have to be rescued. I mean, the only reason to tell that story is that they're putting the lives of the rescuers at risk as well as the people in the cars. And also, you know, don't think the story – if you're a journalist, is about you. I mean, Al Roker and his selfie and with he and his producers there smiling in front of a car that's fallen into the road because the floods have washed it out is kind of inappropriate.
Well, and he has since apologized. Saturday afternoon, word leaked that Hillary Clinton would appear on the season premiere of Saturday Night Live, and that she did, playing the role of Val, the bartender, opposite Kate McKinnon, who played her.
Yeah, you could say that. Whew. Hi. I'm Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Hey, great name. I'm Val. Do you think he'll win the primaries?
He must. I want to be the one to take him down. I will destroy him and I will mount his hair in the Oval Office!
Well, that's kind of a lot. Maybe you should take a vacation.
A vacation?
A vacation.
Vacation change? What do you say?
A vacation.
Did somebody say vacation?
There were a lot of laughs during her appearance. Tell me, how do you think she did?
It looks like they're having a great time. I mean, who wouldn't have fun in that situation, to be able to have that platform to poke fun at the situation going around them, poke fun at a competitor in the presidential race, and, you know, get to be there with funny people all week on Saturday Night Live?
I mean, I think SNL still has its mojo in situations like this. And during this campaign, it's going to be interesting to see who they pick to play some of the other characters. Mm-hmm. I think Kate McKinnon did a decent job as Hillary. But, you know, when you just adore the person, as she has said, she really admires Hillary, you're not going to have quite as sharp an edge. I remember when Tina Fey, of course, you know, was playing Sarah Palin,
sharper
edge, and the humor was a lot, you know, funnier too.
So Saturday night, she was getting Hillary Clinton getting a whole lot of love on NBC. By Monday morning, there was that Pancakes and Politics breakfast and town hall that was on the Today Show, and Savannah Guthrie had some pretty sharp questions.
I actually appreciated that. I mean, you know, she was trying to make the rounds of all of these in a sort of safe havens on television, and even the morning shows sometimes can be perceived that way. But Savannah Guthrie asked her a pretty interesting question. I mean, everybody's been asking her about the server, mm-hmm. right? Well, she was asking the question she asked that really got under Hillary Clinton's skin.
And it
was,
got under her skin.
How would you be reacting if this controversy was happening to one of your Republican opponents? And she didn't like that one little bit, and yet it was a very interesting take on it.
I would agree with that. And, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing to be asked a question like that as a politician when you want to try to control the narrative. And so that's the thing about, you know, being on Saturday Night Live is it's a great platform because you're not facing that. And instead it's a chance to just be fun in the eyes of the public.
Where it's scripted and you also know exactly what's going
to be. I think it'll be fun to see, you know, how many more of those kinds of media moments play out over the next year. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton, when he ran for president, had the saxophone moment, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. That was sort of a defining moment for him in the campaign, and it'll be interesting to see how these things play out.
Saturday Night Live had a couple of other bright spots. The opening monologue with a great riff on some of the news that had happened since the season had last ended with, you know, Rachel Dolezal, Kim Davis, the Minnesota dentist who shot Cecil the Lion, and Donald Trump, too, and really trying to play in and kind of bring back the relevance. Frankly, I haven't been excited for Saturday Night Live since probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years. For some reason, it gave me reason to be excited to want to watch this show.
During presidential years, they always do really well. I think a monkey wrench could be thrown into this sort of calculus that candidates do about safer places to go. Stephen Colbert, now as the host of on CBS, he is sympathetic politically to the Democrats, but he asks some really interesting and off-the-wall and left-of-center questions that might, you know, cause those candidates to think twice about whether it's safe to show up on his talk show or not.
Okay, well, we're going to have to keep watching. I've also started to see some people criticize that show a little bit, saying it feels a lot more like Carson than it ever did, Johnny Carson's show, than it ever did the old Stephen Colbert. So we'll see how that develops over the course of the next few months. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see a preview of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. KBIA's Pat Akers handled the audio, and Claire Banderas is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.